Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the island-chained paradise in the sunny slave South Pacific, where tyranny is so fabulous that people make sure that the one who is most directly responsible for the tyranny, the Prime Sinister, actually winds up being the most popular man in the country. You're going to love that, right? In fact, you'll love this even better. I was criticising the media for not covering the Prime Minister, John Key, properly and exposing his scumbaggery. And then one of these mainstream media people comes up to me and shows me about 10 articles in mainstream media showing how John Key's been lying all the time. And then another article comes out the very next day saying how he's the most trusted and loved Prime Minister ever. You can't make this stuff up, folks. All right. Okay. Let's try to get a grip. I'm going to go to my guest now, Whittemu Bayliss. Welcome to the program.
G'day, Vinny. How you doing?
Somewhat fabulous is my standard response, bro. Hey, here's a joke for you. What do you call a moldy cow?
Uh-oh, here we go.
Whittemu.
Moving on.
Yeah. All right, well, give us a little bit of a background about who you are and what it is you do, bro.
Bit of a background. I'm originally from the sunny metropolis of Porirua, just north of Wellington. But been in the Waikato now for a dozen years or more, and I'm a personal life coach and trying to help people make changes in their lives to lead a bit more of a healthy lifestyle themselves.
Is that what we're going to be talking about today?
I don't know what you've been told, but no, I'm also been dealing with some of those lovely government agencies that you rat bag on a bit. I guess that's partly why I'm here tonight to talk about some of my experiences being a parent without being a parent.
A parent without being a parent.
Yeah.
All right. Well, proceed, because I don't know why you're here today either. I come into these interviews blind, don't know who I'm interviewing or what I'm interviewing them about. There's a lot of work involved with editing and all of that kind of stuff, and that, you know, the whole knowing what you're talking about thing isn't important to me. So, you know, go for your life, son.
All right. No, I guess in part my friend referred me to you is because we've been child, youth, and family caregivers for a young girl for a good part of six and a half, nearly 7 years now. And just on 4 years ago, we underwent Home for Life, basically permanent foster care called Home for Life. And one of the struggles that we've had in our particular situation is that we're dealing with a young girl the child we have in our care, who's 7 years old physically, has fetal alcohol syndrome, a number of other emotional, high emotional needs. In fact, we had a meltdown that's typical when she gets tired, and there's a lot of extra patience, which I'm still learning, and I think every parent needs to learn as they go on. But we're dealing with, in our case, parents, the biological mother, who is a transient alcoholic drug addict, who through the pregnancy, this particular pregnancy, drunk and drugged her way through it, and thus this little girl's got fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Adds another layer of difficulty. And a father who, for all intents and purposes, is a glorified sperm donor. One night stand results in this beautiful little girl, who's also got a child sex conviction against his name, and has in the last year drug us through the courts to try and get access visits to a child he's never met, doesn't know, And where our big issue is, and I guess why I was referred here, is on balance, two biological parents have more rights and on balance have more power than we do who have had this child under our roof for 90% of their life. And that's some of the things that I've been discussing. In fact, this last week I met with the two sitting Hamilton electorate MPs to discuss possible ways of, I guess, restoring the balance back into the hands of the people who have actually got to do the parenting when others aren't capable of doing so.
Well, it's a strange thing, isn't it? The whole aspect of parenting, I think, is just kind of under attack wholesale. You know, if you have a child, your child's not yours anymore. Your child belongs to the state, and it's just a question of whether or not the state wants to take that child from you. Now, if I may, it appears as though there is not adequate representation for children, particularly not in the family courts, and indeed not enough accountability in the family courts. Partly, I believe this is because of the fact that it's actually not possible to report on anything that goes on in the family courts. So if there's any corruption, any unfairness, or anything of that nature, nobody will ever know about it.
I'm not going to deny that there's certainly elements of the family court that couldn't do with improvement. There are various stories that I've heard around judgments that have gone against people who have reasonable cases. I know of a good friend of mine who's a grandfather who's simply just trying to get to be able to have his granddaughter over, for stayovers on the weekend, but because somebody who's not even connected to the family cries foul and makes an accusation, and one psychologist backs up that accusation, even though there's actually no grounds, that he's not actually allowed to have private contact with his granddaughter. And I mean, that's one generation beyond what my wife and I are doing in our home. You know, we're actually directly parenting somebody else's child, we're not talking about a grandparent generation. So, reporting in the family court, I guess there's times when things should be revealed. Absolutely. If there's a vested public interest in it. For example, I think more of the I think if there was issues around, just to pull a case out of the head, the Kahui situation, if there were scenarios in the family court that had played out prior to the actual trial of the dad, then I think that should have come out. I think there should have been more reporting from what had happened in the family court. It was a public interest situation, especially around areas where there's child sex offences and, you know, paedophiles in the mainstream courts that have gone through, well, the people involved have gone through the family courts. I absolutely think that there's a vested public interest in that. In our situation, the family courts treated us pretty good. But that's not to say that it's not balanced in every situation. We had a lawyer who was working for our best interests and represented us extremely well. She was awesome. The lawyer for the child that was appointed eventually by the court, again, was a lawyer for the child that we had worked with previously, who was working for the child's best interests. And fortunately, in this latest situation, the mother, the biological mother, was on the same page as us, and that gave our case extra weight against the dad in this case. So, for us, the family courts worked out very well. I have heard that there are other scenarios out there, and whether reporting would make that more accountable, I don't know. That would have to take the individual's case I think, into account as to whether or not there's a vested public interest in the people knowing.
Mm.
And is it going to damage the families? Is it going to do any, is it going to do good if it's out there?
Yeah. As opposed to the carte blanche, no reporting.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Case-by-case basis.
Case-by-case. I think definitely a case-by-case because especially if there's a high-profile situation, again, just pulling that kahui one out of the hat, if they'd been through the family courts before and they're in a civil case where there's, like, for example, how this whole, you know, closed doors that the family that I spoke to a lawyer friend of mine and says, why don't they just arrest them all for obstruction of justice?
Mm.
You know, those kids deserve justice. And whether the dad did it, I don't know. Whether the mum did it, I don't know. But the fact that everybody just shut up shop and I guess had everybody's backs, you know, and whether that was a family.
Is this the one involving Maxina King, was it?
Yeah, but the dad is the one who actually ended up on trial.
Yeah, yeah. It was actually Ian Wishart wrote a book about that called Breaking the Silence.
Yeah.
And he was called by a number of journalists after the fact because when they were reporting on this case in the public sphere and what have you, it was really incomplete, basically, and the public didn't have the idea of what the heck was actually going on during that trial. And a number of those reporters actually called Ian after the release of his book and to say, yeah, mate, you got it right. We totally got it wrong. But what was interesting is before the book came out, there was actually a public campaign who have never read the book, mind you, because it's not even out yet, to say that it should never even be printed and it shouldn't be on the shelves. It should, you know, like, information is illegal. It's kind of the crazed argument here. But for those who are unfamiliar, particularly the international audience, could you explain what the Kahui case actually was? Do you recall very much?
I'll try and get it, and you might fill in the gaps where I miss out. Basically, there was two young children, Chris and Karu Kahui, who died at home, and they were inconclusive. Basically in the public arena anyway. Nobody could be found responsible for the deaths of these two babies, and eventually charges were laid against the father. He was found not guilty of committing the crime he was accused of. So essentially, now these two children have died in the care of their family. If I remember right, there were some very significant injuries suffered by both the children. But nobody still to this day has been found responsible for committing these acts of violence against these two children. That's the case, and that's a Reader's Digest, probably even worse than a Reader's Digest version of the case. But that's what essentially what it was. Two children physically violently died, infants, babies, you know, violently died. And the family basically, you know, shut up shop, refused to talk to police. Eventually the father was hauled before the courts, accused of the murders. He was found not guilty. And again, you know, that argument, not guilty means innocent, well, doesn't mean innocent, but still nobody today has been held responsible for the deaths of those children.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get back onto your case now. I mean, why is this significant? Why do people need to hear about it? What are the gory, juicy details of this case?
Basically, you know,
using the words gory and juicy in a case involving a child is probably low tact. I'm sorry.
Low tact. No, well, I mean, just to put everybody's mind at ease, there is no gory and juicy details. That basically what we're... There's two elements for us. One is that whole... Even as child, youth and family caregivers, or as Home for Life parents, independent of child, youth and family now, we have full responsibility for the day-to-day care of that child. And I'm not even considering financial support that we receive an unsupported child benefit. That's not even a factor for us. We don't care about that. We're grateful for it, don't care about it. But we have the full measure of responsibility for a child in our care, and yet we don't have all the rights and privileges that a parent has. So a family has a child, biologically it's their child. They can make decisions around school, around travel, around anything like that that they want to do, independent of anybody else. They don't have to get anybody's permission to do things or to go places. Under the law, we are technically supposed to consult with this little girl's biological parents over what school she goes to, the fact that we go to church on Sundays, if we travel domestically, we're supposed to, tell them that we're going to go. I might visit my family in Wellington over a long weekend or, over the school holidays. We're supposed to get permission from these two parents for her to travel, even domestically. And if they disagree, then we have to go to a mediation. And if it doesn't get resolved at mediation, then we could end up having to go to court for this matter. So
sounds like the parents of the child get to, for more or less, rule your life in terms of how you spend it with that child.
Pretty much. We're fortunate, as I said earlier, before, on the most part, that the mother is very supportive of us now. It's taken us a long time to garner her trust. But as I said, the balance of power is not with us. And we don't have the support of child, youth and family that we had as caregivers with them holding the custody. So under Home for Life, under the Home for Life program, custody shifts from under the official orders from the chief executive of child, youth and family to us. So she's no longer a child, youth, and family child. She's not in the system, as it were. And so day-to-day care and custody is in us, is vested in us. And we are co-parents with the biological parents. But as you pointed out, the tail can wag the dog. And even the smallest issue, for example, the fact that she goes to a school a block away from us, could become is potential for a court case if the parents, the biologicals, decided to make it so. The court, in all likelihood, in our situation, find in our favor. But again, the fact that it could go to court is a big issue for us. And like I said, there are many parents or there are many people in our situation who have had to go through court cases to justify the fact that the child goes to a particular school.
Sounds like a whole lot of BS to go through for your mate. And, I don't know about you, but I know a lot of parents. And just raising a child, the sleep deprivation, the extra responsibility, the lack of time to yourself, the all of these things that go with being a parent is stressful enough just to try and raise the child right. What mm-hmm. you're talking about is an extra layer of frickin' impediment on top of it for people yep. who don't even take responsibility for the child themselves in any way.
Yep. Just to give you an example, last year when the biological father made his latest play, for supervised access visits, his lawyer hired a private investigator to serve my wife at work. Now, my wife's a teacher, so they actually broke the law to serve my wife at work. And because they didn't go to the reception, They went trolling around the school, trying to find where her classroom was, and the only way they found her was because she left a sign on her door saying, class this period in this room. And then they served her at work. Now, the principal actually sent a letter to his lawyer saying, you are actually in violation of the law to do this, and never got a response from it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a stress that.
What is it a civil matter or a criminal matter that?
That could have become a civil matter. It would have been a whole nother ball game for him to fight. But it was actually funny to think about that. You know, my wife's school was threatening legal action against the lawyer. That a lawyer actually didn't think about it, but that was a stress because while we understood his desire to, meet his daughter for the first time, our situation or our position really was let her make the decision when, simply because we've put all this information in front of her in a book. That has pictures of her history. It's got pictures of her half siblings. It's got pictures of her biological mum. It's got pictures of her biological dad. And the fact, one of the facts is that we brought up in our response to his service was, she's never asked about you. And how are you going to introduce yourself to this girl? Who really still doesn't quite get why her mum can't have her, or she can't be with her mum, her biological mum, despite teaching her at a level that we think she can understand, that she has a sickness, it's called addiction. It doesn't help her make good choices and keep you safe. And that's not fudging anything. These are real things that she has, but we're not telling her that she's a druggie, you know, that she's a boozer. We're saying she's got a sickness, it's addiction, you know, and just doesn't help her make right decisions and keeping you safe. And she kind of gets that, but, you know, forgets it from time to time. The damage that it could do to her, introduced to a complete stranger and all he could really say is, I'm your daddy. Actually, that's my job right now. You know, that's me. People might say I'm being selfish, but damn right, I'm trying to protect this kid from things that are going to hurt her, not just physically, because if he tries something to a seven-year-old girl, you know, is to go with his previous convictions of child sex offences.
Do you know the details of those sex offences, like what he did?
No, all we know that there were convictions against a minor in terms of the specific details. And he admitted that it was a one-time event. And we weren't worried about supervising the visits. Our worry was the emotional and the psychological problems that it could create, and that her pediatric specialist up here and other specialists who know her consider were more risky than his offences. So on balance, that was more worrying to us as her parents than his conviction was, because again, if he tried anything, good deal to him. I mean, I'm 6'5 and my wife's 6'2, so, you know, we can take care of our own.
Well, irregardless, it doesn't matter how well you can protect a child, because once a child is damaged in a way such as sexual assault and such like that at a tender age, doesn't matter what kind of repercussions happen to the thing, because the damage is done and it's there permanently.
Absolutely.
Not so, worth the risk, I'd say.
No, it's not. And it's being responsible for her, and understanding not only just the physical protection needs, but emotionally, you need to protect her, and psychologically, you need to protect her. And so, This isn't cotton wool stuff. You know, we let her fall off her scooter and fall off her bike, and she can get up and dust herself off and all this stuff. But those underlying issues that meetings like this that you're not prepared for and you rush into can cause a lot more damage and long-term problems. And that's something that we want her to be able to process at a time when she's ready, as opposed to an adult throwing this on her.
That said, what's actually the problem with having a supervised visit?
Again, it comes down to what is he going to say to her? Hi, I'm your dad. And the confusion that will bring into her, because at this point, she's just working out where her mum, her biological mum, fits into the picture. And she gets really upset for a good few days after we have an access visit. And it takes us a while to settle her back down. So it's all good that we could arrange this visit with him, but he doesn't have to deal with the repercussions afterwards.
You do.
We do. And we want, knowing what happens with the mum, knowing what happens post-visits with the mum, we don't want to open this can of worms just yet. We've actually just recently had a confirmed diagnosis of a moderate intellectual disability. And on the scale, you know, you've got mild, medium, and mild, moderate, and high. She's actually in the top third of the moderate section. I mean, she's functional, she can run around, she can walk, but reading Dr. Seuss books for her is a challenge. Let's put it that way.
Hmm.
At seven, you know, you've got to, and even though I don't necessarily agree with the national standards, you use a measurement tool in school. If you could say that she should be at this point of the national standard, then she's not even on the scale yet, you know, as a seven-year-old. So there are things that we're just dealing with that everyday kids, generally in her peers, are miles ahead of her. And the fact is that as she gets older, it's going to get wider and wider and wider.
The gap's going to increase.
The gap's going to increase. And so what we are trying to do is give her as stronger and solid foundation as we can before she experiences anything new, and such as meeting with her dad.
Hmm. Have you ever seen anything like biomedical therapy? Have you ever been looking into these kind of things?
We've been looking at a number of options recently, especially around the support services. For example, we had disability services here recently.
Are they forcing the child to take medication?
No. But it's been suggested, and at this point we're not seriously considering it. Although, at some point it may be required, but we're not hippy greeny natural therapy type people. But at the same time, we believe in the best of both worlds, and so we're looking at different ways to support her through. And medication is a last case scenario for us. I mean, we've talked about Ritalin. I've personally seen good and bad sides of that. If it's managed well and it's looked after, you know, you don't overdo it, you give the right amount and you give it at the right time, everything seems to pan out all right. Last case scenario for us. But you use the tools that are available to you. You use whatever therapies there are available to you, and we'll do what is in her best interests and is the best for the family at the time. Because, again, the day we brought her into our home at 2 years old, 9 kgs, probably no more than 40 centimeters tall, if that, and still wearing infant clothes, you know, this was a very underdeveloped child, to, you know, a sprightly 7-year-old beautiful girl who just loves life. We're still very, very much learning about how her mind is functioning and trying to work on different things to help her to grow and develop as best as we can. Most of her friends we notice at school are up, probably still now, where she's usually in bed 6:30.
Wow. Well, when it comes to medication, I've got a lot of reservations about it. I mean, you take any drug whatsoever, and you give it to a child. Googling side effects of medications and things of that nature is like scary, very just, oh my God, how could you ever give this to a child? But then again, I'm not a medical doctor, so I can't dispense medical advice, can I? And the other element behind here is I think that mainstream medicine has been, I don't know, held back in a lot of ways from giving effective treatments. Actually, I think it's actually on record that Rockefeller Medicine has basically dominated the world medical system. You're aware of the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm? Yeah? Well, Hippocrates came up with that one, and he also came up with another quote. Let food be thy medicine, and let medicine be thy food. Incidentally, medical schools don't teach doctors nutrition at all.
I don't know, I find that surprising. But, no, she actually does eat very, very well. And we try and keep it as whole foods as possible, but it's... Yeah, when it comes to medication, medication is the last case scenario.
Worst case scenario, yeah.
It's the worst case scenario for us. And while we'll think about it, it's not something that's at the forefront of our minds at this point. And we're just taking a lot of advice. And I have a number of people who are very good close friends of mine who are in the medical profession and whose advice I trust outside of our GP and clinicians. And so when Ritalin was first brought up, it was like, okay, what do you think about it? So, and then it was this whole, nah, too young, you know, let's wait for a couple more years, see how she goes. And then, you know, help her to develop self-coping skills, you know, in her way. And just to give you an example, one of the big things that's happened personally for me is I used to weigh somewhere in excess of 250-odd kilos.
Wow.
And I'm now in the 121 to 122 area. And part of some of my changing of habits was changing how I cope with things. And, you know, I was a very emotional eater. And if something stressed me out, I'd reach for a food, or I'd reach for, you know, something to eat, or even just like a 2-liter bottle of Coke or something, you know, something high sugar. And very sedentary lifestyle. Something stresses me out now, I'm usually, you know, going for a swim at the pools around the corner of my gym that's upstairs at the pools, or walk around the block. You know, or snacking on rice crackers is less guilty than having 10 chocolate chip cookies, you know. So how I cope with things has changed. And so that's what we're trying to teach her, is how she copes with things. Helping her to, even if it's just in kids scribble, because writing coherent words and sentences for her is still very fundamental to her. I mean, writing her name, being able to write her name is a success. And celebrating those little successes, and she loves praise. She doesn't like being growly growled. No kid does, I think. But you know, just helping her to realize that getting things wrong, like if she misspells her name, getting it wrong, that's okay. That's cool. You know, don't get frustrated with it. Carry on. Keep trying. But, yeah, definitely medication is not high on the priority list. But us as a family team, my wife and I are both career educators. So we've got different ways of teaching self-coping skills to her and help her through it.
Is she going to school?
Yeah, she's in a mainstream public school.
Yeah.
And we've actually got a lot of support services around here. She has an excellent resource teacher, an RTLB, they call them here, who has some hours with her. Because of her diagnosis that's been officially confirmed now, she's likely to get some more
assistance
support hours in school, in class hours, you know, with the teacher aid specifically for her in school. And to be honest, special schools have been touted, you know, kids, schools specifically for kids with disabilities, or even like going into a disability unit at another school has been discussed, but it's not something that we're looking at this point seriously, because we wanted to develop friendships, and I'm not going to use the term normal, but I wanted to develop as wide a base of friendships as possible. Those who do have challenges, those who do have disabilities of varying kinds, in the mainstream environment. I don't necessarily agree that it's cotton-wooling her at a special school, but I want her to experience school, you know, that everybody else does.
See, me personally, I'd never want my children to experience school the same way everyone else does, because the majority of adults that I talk to think that school sucked.
It took me a lot of years to realize my mum was right, that I went to school to eat my lunch, you know, and I've actually got the genes to prove it. But she enjoys school. When we went away on holiday, you know, fortunately my in-laws made it possible for us to go to the United States, where my wife is from, and we spent 6 weeks over there, and she absolutely loved it, and we got to play with her cousins and experiencing different things that a lot of kids don't usually do. But that's the kind of things we want for her to be able to experience. We wanted to, you know, she knows the New Zealand national anthem. She gets the words wrong. She gets up and sings the Star Spangled Banner mixed in with God Defend New Zealand. That's quite amusing. And she's the whitest, blondest, blue-eyed girl in the Kapa Haka troop at school. You know, and so those are just the things that we want her to experience, the types of things that will help her to grow that I don't think she would necessarily get in another environment. And that's not to say that special schools, as the term was used with the disabilities advisor the other day, special schools don't offer those types of experiences or even better experiences, I guess, than mainstream schools.
Mm.
We want her to experience school life in a classroom with peers, you know, that she's going to grow up with. I mean, I'm still good friends with people I went to high school with. Even now we talk on occasion and reminisce about the good old days, and whether we like school or not was irrelevant. The fact that we've still got those friendships today is what's most rewarding for me.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've taken care of autistic boys before, and the times when I've had to pick them up from their special ed classes and things like that, I actually sat in for about 20 minutes one time, and what occurred to me is that these kids weren't really paying attention to the lessons at all. And because there's only two educators in a room full of, say, 20 reasonably severely handicapped children, it wouldn't even be possible for them to teach all of the children at once something anyway, because they need intense one-on-one kind of thing. I mean, like, that was what I was there for to do that one-on-one thing, because you otherwise the attention just kind of like goes out within seconds, and you got to push them back in, You know, it's actually it's such an intense and dare I say emotionally draining job that perhaps and this is just theorizing on my thing, you can't continue to care.
Yeah.
All right. About the progress of the children. Otherwise, you drive yourself emotionally up the wall. All right. Like it becomes an impossible task to accomplish what you want to accomplish, and as a result, you have to switch off the part of you that cares, just so that you can continue to do this job that doesn't work.
Teachers are amazing people. You know, they are really amazing people. Most of 16 years of my education career has been in the tertiary sector, and so you've got adults who tend to display most of the same characteristics. And this is, funnily enough, an argument I had with the teachers' council, because they refused to register me as a teacher to go into a secondary school because my training was tertiary level, and we disagreed on the fact that adults display the same tendencies and the same behavioral problems in general that teenagers in high school do as children in primary school do. Late last year, I did some teacher aiding work at a high school, and just the attention span of the teenagers during a 45-minute class session is all over the place. And we're doing simple reading exercises at level one to help them get additional NCEA level one credits. Doing a little bit of maths, basic like distance table maths, the distance between, say, Auckland and Wellington and so on, and, you know, nothing massively complicated at all. But the attention spans were remarkably short, and so you have to wonder whether or not some form of attention deficit or autistic spectrum. And I guess coming back to our girl, there's been no formal diagnosis of autism, but definitely there is an attention issue. And, you know, having sat in her class and observed, you know, over the last 2 years she's been at school, this is year three for her. Then, you know, you're right. One teacher in a class with 24 students, and you know that your little girl is not the only one who has some form of attention issue, there's going to be times when A, they don't care, and B, the kid doesn't get the attention that they need. I don't fault the teacher for that.
Yeah.
You know,
it's an impossible situation. I mean, it's like shoving a soldier into a situation where he's on his own up against 100 other soldiers. You know, you can't blame him for getting shot.
No, absolutely. So that's where we're going to be grateful for additional support hours in the class. We don't expect her to come out, you know, as the most brainiac in the class. It's unfair on her. It's unrealistic on our part. And so we're not expecting her to come out with the highest reading level. I mean, she went up last year. She went up three reading levels, and that was just simply because at nighttime, it's a routine that we have after school. The first 30 minutes is she brings home a reading book. You know, if we can get her to write 4 or 5 words, if, and, it, the, you know, then that's good. You know, that's good for us to be able to help her to know that what these words are. And if, you know, we haven't even pushed putting them into a sentence yet. You know, if I am good, you know, I guess you can say your typical teenager's room is what her bedroom looks like, you know, mess everywhere. But just telling her to clean her room is too much. It has to be broken down into the small tasks: shoes in your shoebox, books in your bookshelf, toys in the toy box, but at a single task. So once she's done the first task, you move on to the next one, and you move on to the next one. So,
and through the repetition of this over a period of time, she will learn those lessons and learn how to link those tasks together so that eventually you will be able to say, clean your room, and then she'll equate all of those things.
Yeah.
Two things have occurred to me while you've been speaking is, number one, there was a school in the United States that had a food program change. And I think it was actually a school for, quote, troubled youth. And these children were had some of them like the biological parents of your child, drug abuse problems, parents, and so on and so forth, remarkably difficult to teach. And so what they did is they changed the food that was being served at the cafeteria. They got rid of all the soft drink vending machines and everything out of the school and just gave them healthy, you know, vegetables, fruits, and those kind of things, incredibly healthy diets. And they found that the amount of violence between the students went down dramatically. The amount of attention span of the students, again, went up dramatically. The test scores improved dramatically. So yeah, diet's a huge part of cognitive development as well. If your body has the nutrition that it needs, it can repair itself, it can develop itself very well. And the other thing, there were these twin boys in a school. I forget where the school was. It may have been in Auckland, it may have been in the States, I forget. But the story goes that these two twins were both severely autistic and more or less incapable of communication when they started school. And their educator took specific care with these two kids and tutored them repetitiously, intensely for years and years and years. And they actually wound up becoming quite well educated, made it all the way through seventh form, passing all their exams and everything like that, being able to communicate fully. And that was just because somebody took an active interest. Somebody actually tried to teach them and had the patience to go through that extremely long, drawn-out process of teaching somebody who has a cognitive disability how to do things just over and over and over again. And I believe one of them might have even given a speech at the very end, I think in graduation or something of that nature, fully speaking perfectly. There was nothing wrong with these kids anymore. Everything that was once diagnosed, every disability that was once visible and knowable was gone. And they thanked this teacher profusely for taking that active interest so that they could be, that word that you chose not to use before, normal, like everybody else. And that gives me hope that it is actually possible to reverse all these things. However, again, it takes that intense repetition, schooling, and extraordinary patience upon the educator themselves. And most educators, as you might be well aware, are not the top of the class themselves.
No, definitely not. I mean, I never was the bright spark. I think I walked out of high school with nothing more than, you know, good friends and a good reputation with the teachers. But in terms of academia, no, I didn't even get school C or even vegetable maths for that matter, or cabbage maths as we called it then. But again, I've never believed that qualifications mean that you're good at something. Just proves that you can do something enough to pass a test. And that even, you know, went for when I finished my bachelor's studies a couple of years ago. You know, that was just proved that I was able to given up BS to my professors to make them happy with themselves, I guess, that I was teaching them, that they were teaching me something that, you know, I already knew. But, you know, I've got a lot of hope for our little girl. I really do. As I said, she came to us at 2 years old, 9 kgs. My nephew at 6 months old weighs more than he does. more than she did. She didn't speak. When we put pasta, this little, you know, kid's bowl of pasta in front of her, she was into it with her hands, because we found out previously at her previous caregiver's place, breakfast was corn chips, and it was survival of the fittest when it came to food. And that's just, you know, it was a really sad scenario. We were initially doing respite care, and we put a nappy on her in the morning. We took her back, picked her up later that evening. She was in the same nappy. You know, she'd been in that nappy and been in a porta cot all day, and borderline failure to thrive, as was the diagnosis. And she was under the care of a neurodevelopmental therapist, and she signed off a month and a half after we got this child, saying that she had made enough progress that she was now beyond what she deals with. And she has progressed a significant way from that time when she first came into our home. And so, you know, there's still challenges that she has to and will deal with for the rest of her life. We want her to be, you know, as exposed to as many experiences at this point that are safe for her as possible. And then let her venture out later on. It's not to say that we're going to make all the right decisions, and we'll make all the same bad calls that parents make from time to time. We do that, and I'm learning about how my parents would have felt growing up. They would have made bad calls, and but I always have to look back and say, you know, I was very lucky growing up. I had my parents placed a lot of trust in me. I got away with a lot of stuff, but if I made a wrong decision, there were certainly consequences for my actions. And Ellie's learning, and our girl's learning that too, that there are consequences to bad choices. Usually it involves us confiscating one of her favorite toys for a period of time, and she doesn't like that. So it's going to take a lot of time, a lot of repetition, and just like that basic cleaning her room business, repetition, and daddy's learning patience, which is she knows how to push my buttons, and I've got to remember that. Be calm.
Yeah. Have you noticed that that's actually a problem with a lot of parents, is they forget that they're the adult?
Case in point, right here.
Yeah. It's like, oh, wait, hold on a second. My child can't boss me around because I'm an adult. I've seen this happen, you know, and this is a problem a lot of parents have, is they try to protect their children so much that they protect their children from the consequences of their own actions. And in so doing, the child doesn't believe that there are consequences to their actions. And when they wind up going out into the world for themselves, it's quite a rude awakening. And they go back to their parents, they go, Mum, Dad, why didn't you teach me that there were consequences for my actions? Well, we were trying to protect you from reality.
My dad rings me up a few years ago, telling me my sister had just come to ask him for a few $100s, and when he told me why, I was like, nah, don't do it. It's because she drove drunk and had the car impounded. And, it wasn't her car. It wasn't her and her partner's car. It was a friend's car, and they were driving it. It was unwarranted, unlicensed, unregistered. She was driving it on a learner's license and was drunk. And the car got impounded, and they were going to sell it in 30 days if she didn't cough up with like $300 or $400. And I was like, no, that's her fault. You taught me hard lessons when I was growing up. This is her turn.
Yeah. I mean, apply it equally, yo.
Apply it equally, you know. And And he did. He actually did it in a different way, in that he gave her some of the money. But after she came up with the bulk of it, you know, you come up with this much, I'll... and, you know, growing up with in a Christian environment, you know, it's that whole saved by grace principle where you do some of the work, I'll make up the difference. And that's a lesson that she actually came to appreciate a little while later on. And now that she's a parent, she's beginning to understand the tough decisions that she has to make.
Yeah.
In her child's best interests, as opposed to what she wants to do now.
Yeah. All right. Well, Wadamu Bayliss is my guest, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to go to our first hour break now. Bear in mind, this is a listener-supported broadcast. So if you are capable of going to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and make a donation or set up an automatic payment of a dollar a month or $100 a month or whatever. Whatever you can give is absolutely 100% appreciative. I'm not a collectivist, but however, I'm an individual who's doing the job that the collective needs done for it, and I need the collective to support me in this quest kind of thing. Otherwise, I fall on my ass, and then suddenly New Zealand doesn't have a 5-day-a-week talk show to talk about really important stuff that the mainstream media just won't cover. So thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood as in go ahead, make my news. We'll be right back.